Support for Politics and Public Policy reporting on SDPB is made possible by SDN Communications, your business broadband provider. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. From potential changes to the farm bill that could impact state hemp farmers to proposed changes to the South Dakota Board of Regents' freedom of speech policy, the Dakota Political Junkies are here to make sense of the news. Today, we welcome John Hunter, Madison Daily Leader publisher. He's on the phone from Madison. Hey, John.
Hi, Lori.
Thanks for coming back.
I appreciate it. Thank
you. I just always feel grateful that you come back after.
I'm just a little concerned about the making sense part of your intro there.
Big promises today, big promises. And Seth Tupper is also with us. He's enterprise reporter at the Rapid City Journal. He's joining us from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Black Hills studio downtown Rapid City. Seth, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
All right, let's get started. We're going to start with you, Seth, because we're going to talk about hemp production. And as all great news stories are some of the best news stories, this one looks at an individual and how policy really is affecting his life. So tell us a little bit about the work that you've done with Alex Whiteplume.
Yeah, so Alex Whiteplume is a guy who lives near Manderson on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And for the past couple of decades, he's been on sort of a personal quest to be able to raise hemp as a cash crop. And hemp has long been outlawed in this country. It's kind of been thrown in with its kind of cousin, marijuana. They're both kind of lumped in together, even though hemp won't get you high like marijuana will. And that has been thawing in recent years as marijuana has been legalized for medicinal purposes and recreationally in some states. Attitudes toward hemp have also thawed, and there's been a lot of some research into some of the benefits of hemp as potentially for human health, and it has a lot of other potential uses as well. But anyway, Alex Whiteplume has been blocked from doing growing hemp as a cash crop. The reason he was interested in it is because it takes less water than some other crops, and he thought it would be a good crop for the Pine Ridge area, which is fairly dry. But over the years, he tried to grow hemp. He had his crop seized by federal agents a couple of times, and so he's pretty much been stymied. He even had a federal order against him individually that prohibited him from growing hemp. Finally, a couple of years ago, that order was lifted. But still, hemp was not legal to grow in South Dakota. Anyway, it appears that as part of the farm bill that's pending in Congress right now, hemp may finally be fully legalized nationwide, in large part because people like Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader from Kentucky, has come to view hemp as a potential replacement crop for tobacco. And so it has some powerful people behind it now. And so Alex Whiteplume, though, and some other people aren't waiting. He just decided to start growing hemp again. And he did that, and he has a contract with a Colorado company that's buying his hemp and featuring it in some of their products, nutritional-type products.
Right. And so one of the things that he mentions in the piece that you wrote was in the last, 20 years or so, more than 20 years, he has watched other people who are doing what he's wanted to do become millionaires. So he's sort of saying, in some ways, not only personally, but as a state, as a tribe, the economic influences is passing us by, would be his perspective.
That's true. And, one of the things that concerns me now that you have powerful interests like Mitch McConnell and Big Tobacco and things interested in hemp is that when some of these smaller producers like Alex Whiteplume finally get to grow it, they might be crowded out by, bigger corporate interests anyway. So hopefully not, but we'll see. And right now he does, it is profitable for him. He said he has this contract with this Colorado company. So after a awfully long fight, for the time being, things are going pretty well.
John Hunter, as we watch these sort of, federal rules change, because we also this year had the first FDA approval of a CBD, a drug that includes CBD as an active ingredient. People were wondering in South Dakota, how does that, affect the state law? They're waiting for guidance from the South Dakota State Attorney General, frustrated at the pace that guidance was coming. Is the ag industry sort of, you know, from a small farmer perspective and from a state perspective, ready to capitalize on the economics of something should it become legal federally?
Well, there's all those moving parts, as you described, Lori. I mean, you've got federal...
Make sense of it, John.
Yeah. That's a tall order.
Sorry.
So, you know, federal, they're going to, you know, they're doing some things, and it seems as though, given our current state of affairs in D.C., that these things are already kind of tentative. So you get, you know, a one branch of Congress would pass something, but the other doesn't, sitting in it, or it's sitting in a committee, or it's not being brought to the floor, or it's waiting on a president's desk, or those kind of things. So there always seems to be uncertainty, and then someone says, yeah, then we're going to appeal it, it's going to go to court after that. And then, so then you get the state laws, which then, to a degree, are similar, although in South Dakota we tend to be pretty efficient with these things, that if it doesn't get done in the legislative session, it dies, it doesn't kind of go into permanent limbo. But then now you add the third level, you actually have tribal law. And so the sovereign nation kind of things, how does that affect when, which ones overrule the others and all this. So it gets in very complicated. And I can see how in this case, you know, this, I'm just going to do it because I'll never get kind of pure legal satisfaction out of these multiple layers of governments and so on. So it is very confusing. You got a moving target. You know, they talk about some states having broken the ice on some of this kind of stuff. Others say, no, we still don't want to do it. It's very complicated.
Right. And Seth, that's what Alex White Plume is saying, which is what he was saying before, that there's tribal sovereignty for this, so he can continue to make this decision. And then also sort of maybe crossing his fingers that change is on the way.
Right. Yeah, he's operating on the theory that you know, the Oglala Sioux Tribe legalized hemp growing on the reservation, so he's saying that he's covered there, and also the injunction that was formerly against him from the federal government was lifted a couple years ago, so he's saying I'm good to go. Well, you know, the state of South Dakota, still technically you can't grow hemp legally here. But we'll see. It seems unlikely anybody's going to stop him from growing hemp at this point. But as I said, he has had federal agents on his land raiding his hemp crop before last year. So
the DEA has taken personal interest in him previously, which was somewhat unprecedented as well. Interesting. We'll take a follow that story as it continues to develop. And you can read Seth's piece about it at RapidCityJournal.com. And now let's switch gears a little bit and talk about a proposed change. South Dakota Board of Regents has released proposed changes to what was a freedom of speech policy. Now it's being called a commitment to freedom of expression policy seeking public comment. Also made some changes to the student code of conduct and sexual harassment policy changes. But, John, let's talk about this freedom of expression policy manual change. What's driving this conversation?
Well, I'm actually thrilled about this prospect of this policy. The world has certainly changed on college campuses in the last couple of generations. So from a time when college campuses were the beacons of free speech and protests and all the kinds of things during, you know, Vietnam and so forth, and then kind of the pendulum has swung far the other way, where we have you know, timeouts and safe spaces and make sure that, you know, no one uses a word that would offend another person, and kind of swung far the other way. And so this policy is intended to try to return some method of undisturbed free speech on campuses. And when I say it goes partway, it certainly does its best to open it up, but there's still, you know, concerns about hate speech and those kinds of things that it would obviously are part of law as well. But the whole idea is that college campuses should be a place where people are can debate sensitive topics not be in faculty's case, fired or denied tenure because of allowing free speech. So I think the Board of Regents is doing the right thing here. I'm hoping the public does get involved with this. I'm sure there will be some people who will oppose this. Remember that, again, the kind of this, and it may very well be the whole irony in this, Lori and Seth, is that students may actually protest this. Like, we don't want free speech. And there was a case at a college not too long ago where a faculty member said, well, you know, use your own judgment as far as Halloween costumes this year so you don't offend anyone. And students protested and got that faculty person said, no, you, it's your responsibility to tell us what Halloween costumes to wear because, you know, and the faculty was got in trouble for suggesting that students could make their own decisions about their Halloween costumes. So it would be ironic that students would protest a new right given to them, that guaranteed by the Constitution, but it would surprise me.
Seth, give me a little idea of what some of those students might be saying, because it seems that some of those protests are against individual speakers on campus that they would like to block or shout down. Or what do you think is driving some of the richness of this debate or the tension around it? Because it seems like free speech is something everyone can get behind.
Well, nationally, it seems like you know, everybody's behind the concept of free speech, but then until maybe you're on campus and somebody wants to give a speech advocating white supremacy, and I guess that's the crux of the argument: is what do you do about that? How do you balance your desire to support free speech with your responsibility not to as a university administrator and somebody who, you know, receives and spends public funds, not to provide a platform for somebody to spread hate speech? And then, of course, you get into arguments of, well, are these people actually, you know, advocating what they're alleged to be advocating or not? And so it's a really thorny issue, and I don't think it's one that'll ever be fully settled. And in some ways, that's a good thing. It's healthy to be having these arguments about you know, what's actually protected speech and what's not. So it's really complicated. I don't envy the regents or the university administrators. It's further complicated by the fact on college campuses you're dealing with students who are in some ways considered adults, in some ways not. And so I don't know where this is headed. But it's as John mentioned, it is something that certainly has swung to both extremes in a few generations.
So, John, this is an interesting because I have a daughter who's, you know, looking at colleges right now. So we've been able to do some college visits, and we went to one recently. And during the tour, the tour guide, who is a student, said walked into, you know, this hall, the chapel area where they have speakers, and was proud of the fact that they had you know, very diverse opinions in this room, gave us some examples of people, said, you know, the students weren't very happy about this one speaker because it was against what most of the people who go to this university believe. But we think it's important to, you know, to have these different viewpoints. And then when we had one of the students we sat down with for, you know, the college interview, I asked her more about that. And I said, what did you learn about the student body by how they reacted to the speaker who came, who was, you know, a white supremacist, essentially, by her definition? And it was fascinating because she said, I learned that the students at this school care more about the school than they do about themselves. So she found it to be this opportunity for all the students to come over and get together. You know, maybe they didn't turn their papers in on time, didn't worry about their grades for a weekend, and they decided, what is this institution supposed to be, and how are we going to respond to this? So in some ways, John, it seems like an opportunity for a lot of kids in college to sort of learn, how do we deal with offensive and hateful comments, as well as, you know, how do we deal with things? There's a lot to discuss and unpack, and we're better to do that than college.
Yeah, I fully concur, and that it's great for students. And remember, maybe the recent generation or two, and I'm a parent of two former college students, and recognize that our generation of parents raised kids in a protective bubble. Remember, we had them sit in car seats until they were 21, and you know, make sure if the soccer practice was a block away that we would walk them to soccer practice and supervise them at all times. And so that's the most people, kind of sociologists, believe that's kind of how this got started, kind of overprotected children now not quite being prepared to handle the disagreements that adults sometimes have. And so that's kind of got how the safe spaces got set up. So that if a student feels as though they're in a class and someone uses a swear word, that they can rush off to a safe space. In fact, Brown University, kind of widely mocked for setting up these safe spaces, or a safe space that included cookies, coloring books, Play-Doh, calming music, and a video of frolicking puppies. So to make the students feel better about themselves. So I think that pendulum that's the farthest I'm hoping the pendulum has swung that way, that this policy and others can bring it back.
Okay, what about this notion, though, Seth, of kids in universities who, and when John describes that room, I'm also reminded of some of these businesses who have created places for you to work with the ping pong table or beanbag chairs, and what they're trying to do is to say, we can do better in our built environments. We can create things that will give people a break from the cubicle. So what's wrong in some ways with college students saying, you know what, we can create this space that's sort of over the top gentle, but what we're trying to say here is, we can build an environment where you get a break from the, oppression of the world, and what the heck is wrong with that?
I don't know that there is anything necessarily wrong with it. I mean, it's important to point out for some of these students and some of the college administrators, I think some of their actions that have been mocked probably flow from a place of good intentions, which is a sense that we need to have inclusion and we need to have civility and equality, but that's the challenge, is determining if what's the difference between free speech and for example hate speech, and where do you draw that line, and is there a line, and do you draw it? So like I said, I mean it's encouraging that the debate's being had, and I think it's one that'll just, it'll never fully be settled.
Right. John, how does it play out in South Dakota universities? Because we're not Brown.
No, we aren't. But the question, I think, for South Dakota, we have beautiful campuses. I mean, wonderful places already. They're not suffering hardships, even though they may not have Play-Doh and pillows and blankets in these safe spaces. They're comfortable campuses. So I think what it does, get back to a little bit of fundamental, what is the purpose of higher education? And then to a degree, I think it's to prepare people for the world, right? And so whether it's an occupation or, participating in society or being a good citizen or those kinds of things. And so I think it's possible, at least, that some stress can be part of that, maybe
sure,
in minor ways, to introduce the idea of disagreement, which does happen in the real world. And I think sometimes, if you look back four generations, the founder of these educational institutions said it was never really intended for a four-year vacation. It was kind of more intended to prepare you. So, frankly, students live a lot better than I do. Can't be beautiful buildings and prepared food and all this kind
right,
of
right, but
stuff.
Here's my core question, John, and you know why I'm asking it, but are we preparing them for the world? Or are we preparing them to make the world a better place? And we can find all kinds of funny snowflake stories, but in general, aren't we also asking them to think for themselves? And if the students create a space and say, we think this is a better way to live, and it has to do with, baking cookies every Thursday, why the heck not take that into their businesses and their entrepreneurial ideas and their classrooms in the future? They can make it better.
Understand.
I want cookies.
I know. And the students should lead that thing, but I don't think the administrators should protect them from the realities of the world.
Mm.
If students say, look, we can do better, let's rally around, we're going to protest the fact that we don't have cookies or whatever, and then there might be some students who say, I don't want to pay an extra $10 a credit hour for cookie fees or whatever, and then we have an honest, open debate about that. And so I do like the idea of student-driven discussions, that it's not a legislator or a college administrator or a donor, maybe even a worse scenario where a large donor said, look, I'm going to donate a lot of money to the university. It comes with this catch, though, that we have to have puppies on campus to make us feel better, those kind of things. So I do like the engagement. And frankly, a little bit of that, Lori, comes from being a journalist, that I think that you know, free speech, free press, and all those kinds of things are good for a democracy. I don't like most circumstances where that's oppressed by others, whether it's a government official or a college administrator or that sort of thing. So I'm generally open to that kind of stuff. I understand limitations, and Seth's brought up some good ones about hate speech and those sorts of things. But I think if we're to err, we err slightly on the side of allowing more open discussion rather than stifling it.
And it seems like that brings us back to the beginning, because you also mentioned, you know, the donors and some of the money, and some of this policy is specifically, as it's written, is laid out to, you know, just because it's the speaker on the campus is maybe against your institutional values, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't still have to protect free speech. So there's lots underlying.
Well, there's some other ones, yeah, too, Lori. You know, accreditation agencies are influencing college campuses. Right. Partly because of the money, is if you don't get a certain accreditation, you may not be eligible for certain federal funds and that sort of thing. So some of this is out of the hands of college administrators. Some of it might be a bureaucracy far away that creates this kind of stuff. And there's all sorts of influences that kind of conspire. And what if you have a government that's controlled at the moment by one party? Can you say, look, no college campuses are going to allow speakers by the other party?
Right.
I'm not saying that's an extreme situation, but I can see it happening.
Some days it feels like we live in extreme times. So, John Hunter is a publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. Seth Tupper is enterprise reporter at the Rapid City Journal. So much to talk about, and we got to two things, but they were pretty important things. So thank you, gentlemen, so much, John. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lori. It was a good show.
Seth, thanks as well.
You bet.